Case number 19-5331, Committee on the Judiciary of the United States House of Representatives versus Donald F. McGahn, II, Appellant. Mr. Mopan for the Appellant, Ms. Barbero for the Appellee.
Mr. Mopan, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The House Judiciary Committee seeks to assert an implied cause of action to enforce a subpoena to compel Mr. McGahn to testify regarding his duties as White House counsel over the objection of the President of the United States. This interbranch dispute over institutional prerogatives bears no resemblance to the traditional cases or controversies that can be heard under Article 3. Moreover, while Congress has purported to authorize Senate committees to sue to enforce certain subpoenas against non-federal officials, Congress itself has expressly carved out the authority of the Senate to enforce subpoenas against federal executive officials asserting executive prerogative objections. And
what does the Senate statute, how does that help us think about the constitutional issue, the justiciability issue?
Well, so I think it does in two ways, Your Honor. First, we have a straight-up subject matter jurisdiction argument because of the Senate statute. But the second point is, if you rule for us on the argument that there's no statutory authority, no subject matter jurisdiction, this Court can avoid the serious constitutional questions presented by Article 3. And in fact, for that reason, even if you...
Isn't that the more fundamental question, though? The Article 3 question?
Look, both Article 3 standing and federal subject matter jurisdiction are jurisdictional questions. They're both very important, and they're both threshold grounds that have to be decided before you can reach the merits. But as between the two of them, there is not a order of priority. The courts have recognized that you can decide one or the other first. And principles of constitutional avoidance would suggest that if the court resolves the question on statutory grounds, it can defer for a later day the serious constitutional question.
Well, let me ask you about the serious constitutional question. After Raines, in your view, when may Congress or a chamber of Congress assert an institutional injury?
We don't think they ever can, Your Honor, but certainly not in a case where it's an injury against asserted injury against the executive branch. We think that Raines reaffirmed the proposition that a dispute, an injury, only gives rise to an Article III controversy when it's the type of dispute that has traditionally been resolved in federal courts.
But I mean, the Supreme Court has said there is such a thing as institutional injury, right?
Only
you've got Coleman, you've got Arizona State Legislature case.
Only for state legislatures, and in both Raines.
Why would that make a difference?
Because of the separation of powers problem. There are serious separation of powers concerns with having a federal court resolve an interbranch dispute, and this is laid out in great detail in Raines. Raines specifies that over history there have been countless disputes between Congress and the President, and in none of those disputes have they been resolved through interbranch litigation over a claimed injury to official authority or power. The court went through examples like the President not suing over the Tenure of Office Act and Congress not suing over pocket vetoes. And after a long discussion of that, it's 3 pages in the discussion of Raines and only a 12-page opinion. After all of that, it culminates in the conclusion of Raines. And the conclusion of Raines is that while it might not be irrational to have a scheme in which courts heard those sort of disputes, it is obviously, the court said obviously, not the regime
but here,
that is
here, obtained. Here we have a rather straightforward claim of executive privilege, right? Doesn't the Nixon tapes case invite us to resolve this dispute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what Raines makes clear is it's not sufficient that the legal issue, the merits issue, be the sort of issue that courts can resolve. In Raines, of course, the constitutionality of the Line Item Veto Act was a sort of question that courts can resolve. In fact, the Supreme Court resolved it the very next term in Clinton versus New York and resolved it in favor of the unconstitutionality, the very claim that was made by the congressman in Raines. So what Raines tells you is it's not sufficient that the merits question be subject to judicial resolution. The question for standing, of course, is whether the plaintiff is the proper party to bring that suit. And what Raines described after it went through the history that I just discussed, the conclusion of it was, while you could have schemes where that resolve those sort of interbranch disputes, it is not what we have traditionally done under Article 3, where Article 3 courts exist to resolve protect the rights of individual citizens, not to engage in the amorphous supervision of the government.
So with Senate Select Committee and AT&T, those are our ventures into legislative standing. Are those wrongly decided?
Senate Select Committee, there are different answers to each case. So Senate Select Committee, there's no, the court doesn't address Article III standing, so it's a drive-by. We do think that there was not Article III standing in that case. As to AT&T, it's a different case both in terms of its facts and its posture. So AT&T commenced in district court as a suit by the United States to sue a private company. That is, of course, a traditional case or controversy brought by the U.S. as sovereign to enforce its sovereign prerogatives represented by the executive branch, the branch of this government that represents the United States in litigation.
Yeah, but the reality of the case was that it was an interbranch dispute over information.
So I don't think – it is certainly the case that the House intervened to defend its subpoena, but that doesn't change the fact that the nature of the dispute in district court was –
But the nature of the court's analysis was all about the interbranch dispute over information, and that's what we have here.
That's the merits question, but in terms of the standing, in terms of whether there was a case or controversy, focusing on who the plaintiff was and who the defendant was, which is what's critical for standing as opposed to the merits, it was a suit by the United States to tell a private company not to disclose information.
All right, but to the extent you're distinguishing that case on factual and contextual grounds, Raines talks about having the proper party. Now here we have a different party in the nature of the committee than we do, and then was before the court in Raines. So the committee has been authorized by the full House. Doesn't that change your analysis necessarily?
So I think you're exactly right, Your Honor, that neither AT&T nor Raines is on factual all fours. And so then the question becomes, what about the reasoning of these cases?
That's what I'm focusing on.
And so I'll say two things. AT&T has no reasoning. It has a single sentence with no explanation. Raines has 3 pages of reasoning about why interbranch disputes, and they're not talking about individual congressmen. They say suits between one or both houses of Congress and the president. They talk about how the president never sued over the line item veto act.
So,
they talk about how Congress never sued over a pocket veto. So while it is certainly true that the facts of Raines involved individual congressmen, the reasoning of Raines goes far broader. And that is essentially what my friends on the committee are arguing.
But
here,
I hear you arguing this morning for an absolute rule that it really doesn't matter who the plaintiff is. It could be the full Congress as opposed to just one House.
Because the reasoning of Raines is that interbranch disputes between one political branch and another political branch over their institutional prerogatives, with no private party to be seen anywhere.
So go back to what the framers had in mind in having 3 branches of government. The hypothetical, obviously, is where one branch, arguably, is stymied in its ability to carry out a constitutional duty. There is no remedy available under our constitutional system other than at the ballot box.
There's no judicial remedy. I'll say 2 things about that, Your Honor. The first is I would refer Your Honor to Justice Souter's concurrence in Raines, which is directly on point for this, where he emphasizes that these sort of interbranch disputes are far afield from the traditional cases or controversies.
True, but that's not the same as saying it's an absolute bar to any such judicial remedy.
Your Honor, I do think that the reasoning of Raines says that is an absolute bar, that federal courts exist to resolve disputes concerning the rights of private parties.
So deal with my hypothetical.
Right. And so the answer to your hypothetical, the second part of what I was going to say, is that this court in Campbell versus Clinton addressed this question and said it's not that there are no remedies, it's that there are political remedies. When you have a dispute between the political branches, that is resolved through political tools. And the House has powerful...
Such as?
So the House has powerful tools to block appropriations, to block legislation. If the Senate agrees with the House, they can block nominations, they can affirmatively pass legislation. The Senate and the House together... Congress,
and they can make it the grounds for impeachment, for obstruction of Congress.
So Campbell versus Clinton did talk about impeachment being one of the tools that Congress has. I'm not going to get into whether on any given fact pattern that would be proper or not, but it is certainly one of the tools that Congress has. Congress has powerful, powerful tools to check the presidency, and that's what the courts have routinely recognized. If anything, Congress is the more powerful branch. So but what Congress has never done until very recently is, instead of using its political tools, instead of using its power of the person, the power of the legislature.
Senate Select Committee is the first case we have, isn't it? 1974.
So it's the first case, I think that's right, with one very important exception. In 1928, the Reid decision that we talk about in the Supreme Court, a Senate committee did try to sue to enforce a subpoena, and it did so pursuant to a Senate resolution that said it could not only issue the subpoena, but take any steps necessary. And the Supreme Court held that that was not authorization to sue. And the reason the Supreme Court gave for why it was not authorization to sue is that there was a wide divergence between the power to issue a subpoena and the power to sue to enforce it. That is just exactly the reason why they don't have the sort of injury that supports Article III standing. It goes to the broader separation of power principle.
May I ask you about your claim of absolute testimonial immunity? The Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected the president's claim of absolute testimonial immunity. How is this case different from the instances which this court has rejected?
So I'm not sure what instances Your Honor is referring to.
The Mixon Tapes case.
So that case, A, did not involve testimonial immunity. It involved document production. And B, it did not involve a congressional subpoena. It involved a judicial subpoena, both of which are very significant differences. But I'm happy to talk about more about the merits, but there are several other threshold jurisdictional points that I would like to address before the merits.
I just want to ask you on standing.
Yes.
Your position is no one has standing.
The broadest formulation of our argument would be that Congress, when it's asserting its institutional prerogatives, never has standing. But the narrower version, and it's all that's necessary to resolve this case, is say at a minimum not when it's an interbranch dispute. When they're
that's
suing.
That's what I'm talking about. In an interbranch dispute, no one has standing.
That is our position, Your Honor.
Subpoena. No one has standing to enforce this subpoena in this court.
That is our position, Your Honor. We think it follows from Reins, and I think as a matter of separation of powers, that's true for two very important reasons. One, it's a shifting of power from the executive to the legislature, and two, and probably more importantly, it is a radical change to this court's role and one that poses real danger to this court. So on the first, I'll be brief because we've largely talked about it, which is, as we cited in our briefs, Buckley versus Vallejo makes clear that the power to file lawsuits on behalf of the United States vindicating public rights is vested in the executive, not the legislature. And Buckley talks about this. It explains that the Federal Election Commission, if all it was doing was obtaining information, that might have been okay. And it actually cites McGrane, the case about the congressional right to gain information. But then what it says is the FEC had more power than that. The FEC had the power to bring lawsuits. And they said that that is no part of the legislative role, and that's why the Supreme Court in Buckley struck down the original FEC. So, and the flip side of that is Congress has never had the authority to file lawsuits, and that was the discussion we had about Reid and McGrane. But I'd like to make one last point on standing, which is the role of the courts. And this is a point that Justice Souter made very eloquently in his concurrence, which is the reason it matters that this is an interbranch dispute rather than a dispute involving private rights is because federal courts have historically existed to adjudicate private rights, and if you instead have them resolving a purely political dispute between the political branches, it risks politicizing the court and undermining public confidence in the court. And I can't think of a better case to explain that than the facts of this case. The House committee in this case has cited our legal position, our merits position, as evidence of why the president has engaged in obstruction of justice and should be impeached. If this court rules on the merits, one way or the other, you can be assured that the opinion that this court issues will be waived on the floor of the Senate by one side or the other as evidence that either the president is guilty or the president is innocent. That is exactly the problem that Justice Souter and the majority in Reins was worried about.
But that can happen in any litigation. And you know that as well as I.
I do. And what Justice Souter said about exactly that point, Your Honor, is it is certainly true that the federal courts will sometimes have to adjudicate deeply controversial issues, deeply political issues. But at least when it does it in the context of a private person's rights, when it's protecting private parties from the government, from other private parties, that is the traditional rule of federal courts, and the public understands that that is the rule of federal courts. When instead you have a political food fight, when you've got Congress on the one side and the executive on the other side, and the judiciary in the middle picking and choosing who the winners are, that is not the traditional role of the federal courts, and that is when the public might wonder why, with all respect, unelected, unaccountable judges are deciding who wins a political fight.
We know that happens when the Supreme Court rules in some of these controversial
cases. My only point is,
we know that.
It's a matter of necessity in those cases.
And yet what is traditional is not necessarily a definition of the total authority.
All I could say, Your Honor, is that Raines does say quite clearly that in addition to having a concrete injury, it has to be the type of dispute that's been traditionally resolved in federal courts. It has a lengthy discussion of how these types of disputes between the House, not just members of Congress, but the House.
But we and the Supreme Court have made it clear that opinions of the court, the Supreme Court, must be read in context of what was particularly at issue and what the holding of the court was.
The
rationale and the reasoning and the explication may go beyond that, as we all know. So that's why I started out with my hypothetical, and your response to Judge Henderson makes it perfectly clear. There are no circumstances in the Department of Justice's view when this type of matter, enforcing a subpoena in order to carry out a constitutional duty, is properly in the court.
So, to the contrary, Your Honor, I think this court has a long line of cases that recognize that it will not be bound not just by the strict holdings and precise facts of Supreme Court opinions, but carefully considered language of the Supreme Court will be treated as authoritative.
I understand. Dicta.
Even if it's dicta. The three pages in Raines can't possibly be characterized as dicta. It is essential to the reasoning. It is essential to Justice Souter's concurrence. And the idea that this court would say none of that matters and all Raines stands for is this narrow factual proposition.
Well,
we don't have to say that. Right.
Well, otherwise they have no affirmative basis to have standing unless you say that the rationale of Raines is cabined to individual members. You have to say the last.
Haven't we already recognized the power of Raines and Chenoweth?
Right.
Haven't we recognized that Raines does affect our prior approach to legislative standing, our creative approach back in the bad old days?
Right, and what it has done is reject every single attempt by federal legislators to bring a case of controversy in Chenoweth and Campbell. It has never confronted this precise issue of whether what Raines' implications are for the full body rather than individual legislators. But what I was saying is that the reasoning of Raines, there are three pages of that opinion that are not talking about individual legislators, that are talking about disputes.
Can I ask you about the merits now?
Sure. I do have subject matter jurisdiction, but I'm happy to answer.
Okay. So you've been riding the Raines horse pretty strong, pretty gallantly,
yes.
Right? Now, Raines tells us that history matters a great deal.
Yes.
In these separation of powers issues. Okay. Well, the Engel memorandum from the Department of Justice, the Office of Legal Counsel, says the first example of this absolute testimonial immunity, that's where I'm going, is in 1944. That's more than 150 years after the founding. Why should we elevate this late stage innovation to the point of constitutional law?
Well, to be clear,
history may help you on your Article III standing argument, and that's all you would need to win on prevail. But if we disagreed with you on that, history hurts you on your testimonial privilege.
Exactly, right? To the contrary, Your Honor. It is true that the first written opinion describing this might be then, but they don't have any historical examples of Congress subpoenaing the president or his close advisors and those individuals testifying under compulsion, as opposed to choosing to testify. Of course, the give and take between the political branches has always been.
Has there ever been an instance of such broad-scale defiance of a congressional request for information in history of the Republic? Has there been anything like this?
Your Honor, I think that question, with all due respect, underscores exactly why there are real dangers with this court getting into the merits.
What's the answer to the question?
I don't want to fight with the characterization of the premise, but there's a big dispute about whether this is a wide-scale massive resistance or whether what is wide-scale massive resistance
an instruction has been given from the President of the United States not to cooperate in any form or fashion with an inquiry. Has that ever happened before?
Not
directed to one individual who occupies a particular position. Those are the cases you've been talking about before. But everyone for the administration. Has that ever happened before?
Not to my knowledge.
No, it hasn't.
I think what the President would say in response to that, Your Honor, is never before in history has Congress engaged in the sort of illegitimate inquiries they're doing. I don't want to get into that fight because that is exactly the sort of political dispute that this Court should not be engaged in. This Court should not be refereeing who's right or wrong about whether the President is acting totally unusually or Congress is acting totally unusually. That is exactly why this Court should stay out of the merits of this case.
But that's the way you want to characterize the issue. There is a more limited way to characterize the issue that my hypothetical tried to point out. In other words, legal questions come before courts that may have collateral political consequences where members on both sides use the court's decision to support their position. That's a different issue, though. This court doesn't have to decide the merits of the impeachment inquiry in order to decide whether or not it has a proper party before it, and that party has all the other jurisdictional requirements, in terms of simply what I'll describe, and I know you'll challenge this, a procedural matter of enforcing a subpoena.
Look, I agree.
For not only testimony, but documents.
No, there's no documents in this case, Your Honor. The
materials.
It's only testimony. The parties have resolved their disputes over documents. All this case is about testimony.
So all the documents, including the grand jury transcripts and other matters, and related to
those are other cases, Your Honor. In this case, the McGann case that we're arguing right now.
Well, I don't want to bring in matters outside the record, but we all know there are materials that have not been produced.
Yeah, I'm not disputing that, Your Honor.
All right, so this is still a live issue.
Yeah, perhaps, just not in this case.
No, in this case.
Their subpoena in this case is for testimony of Donald McGann. It's not for anything else. If I could address the jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdictional question, I haven't had a chance to. I think, as we've been discussing, I think at a minimum, the standing questions are serious constitutional questions here, given that there are three pages of Reins that support us. And so then the question is, can you avoid that serious constitutional question? I think there's an easy way to do so here, because Congress itself has addressed the circumstances where congressional committees can sue to enforce subpoenas. It has authorized Senate committees to do so, but only in certain circumstances. It has carved out precisely this sort of subpoena against executive branch officials and hasn't authorized the House to sue at all. I just do not think you can read that statute as allowing the House to circumvent it and to end run all the careful restrictions that are in 1365. And if I could just expand on that for a moment.
But why don't you respond to the committee's response to that argument about your statutory exclusion?
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure, to be honest, which of two different points they're making, so I'll respond to both. So at times they seem to suggest that 1365 doesn't displace 1331 at all, that you can always just invoke 1331. That, I think, is a complete non-starter, because the way 1365 is set up, in order to invoke it, the Senate first has to get full resolution from the Senate, including through a committee process. You then have
Why isn't it just belts and suspenders? You got 1331, there was a question about the amount of controversy, Senate was unsure, so they just went ahead and did this to...
Because it's not belts and suspenders, there are limits. There are careful limits
right,
in the statute.
Right.
There are limits about when the Senate is authorized to sue. There are limits about where they can sue. They can only sue in D.C. There are limits on the remedies that can be authored. There's only civil contempt, not criminal contempt. If you take their position, they can end run all of that. The House Judiciary Committee could go without going through the committee process. They could file suit, not in D.C.
Well, the House could. 1365 is about the Senate only.
Right. So, again, they have two steps of their argument. Even take the Senate. On their view today, now that there's no amount of controversy requirement, the Senate presumably could invoke 1331, not go through the committee process, not file suit in D.C., seek criminal contempt, and just say, oh, I have 1331. all those limitations in 1365 are very nice, but we're not going to comply with any of them. That is just not a plausible reading of the statute. And if there were any doubt about it, and we didn't have a chance to put this into the brief, Your Honor, and I apologize, but I would like, this is the bipartisan statements of the sponsors of the 1996 amendment to 1365. It's Senators Specter and Levin. If I could just briefly read it, the citation is 142 Congressional Record 19412 and 413. So this is Senator Specter. The intent, he's talking about 1365. The intent is to make it clear that judicial enforcement is available when a person is asserting a privilege personal to him or her, but not when the person is asserting a governmental privilege available only to the executive branch. The purpose is to keep disputes between the executive and legislative branches out of the courtroom. Here's Senator Levin on the same point. Section 1365 generally authorizes judicial enforcement of a Senate subpoena, except when a subpoena has been issued to an executive branch official acting in his or her official capacity, an exception that seeks to keep interbranch disputes out of the courtroom. There is simply no doubt that Congress did not want the Senate to be able to end run the careful limitations in that statute and file suit under 1331. And I think they largely agree, because ultimately where they fall back on is the point that this is about the Senate, not about the House. And that, I think, just holds even less water, because the notion that when Congress gave the Senate limited authority to sue and gave the House no authority to sue, that somehow means that the House has more authority to sue, turns the statute on its head. And if there were any doubt about it, there's the conclusive refutation of it is this court in 1981. It's the application for Senate permanent investigation of subcommittees. It's the case we cited in our briefs. This court said that prior to 1978, prior to the 1365 statute being enacted, Congress had only two means to enforce its subpoenas. It could ask the executive to bring criminal contempt, or it can invoke its own inherent civil contempt. That's exactly, by the way, what the Senate report says. The Senate reports that are also cited in our brief, if you look at page 16 of that Senate report, when it talks about the need for the statute, it says the exact same thing, that there were only two means of enforcing it. Their argument that somehow lurking in the background, unbeknownst to everyone, was this floating grant of jurisdiction and cause of action under 1331 just has no support. That is just not how anyone in Congress thought these statutes worked together. And at a minimum, it is unclear.
Does your argument signal that we should look forward to future discussions from the Justice Department about legislative history? We've got a new day has arrived?
We think it is clear on the face of the statute, okay, Your Honor, that what Congress was trying to do was carve off these suits, and their suggestion that there was some other mythical purpose is belied by the legislative history. But the only point I was making was, at a minimum, there's ambiguity here. And if there's ambiguity about whether there's statutory jurisdiction to begin with, and there's a serious constitutional question about whether it would be permissible, what this court should do as a matter of constitutional avoidance and judicial restraint is to hold that they don't have statutory authority to sue. And then what is the result? The result is that if Congress wants the committee to sue, Congress can pass a statute. And if ever there was a party who can't complain about being forced to ask Congress to pass legislation, it is the House Judiciary Committee. They are part of the Congress. If they have political support to authorize this lawsuit, they can pass a statute.
It takes two.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That is a feature, not a bug. The Supreme Court has made clear that the point of bicameralism and presentment is precisely to prevent one House of Congress from acting rationally.
But you're listing remedies that require cooperation. And the whole thesis that you're presenting to the court is this is total non-cooperation and the courts ought to stay out of it.
My point is, there are serious Article III questions about whether the House should be able to sue. And before this court resolves those, and before the House committee can force this court to resolve them, at a minimum, Congress as a whole should actually want this court to resolve them. And there's a good reason for that, by the way, Your Honor, and over and above judicial restraint. There are good reasons.
Would 1365 be constitutional if it didn't have the exception for governmental privileges?
So again, Your Honor, the broadest version of our argument is whether or not they're suing an interbranch dispute or private parties, we don't think they have Article III standing. Mm-hmm. We think it is particularly clear that they don't have Article III standing if they're suing the executive branch in a purely interbranch dispute. But the point I was going to make was the reason why this matters, it's not just a matter of...
Maybe you answered it and I missed it. Would 1365 be constitutional? I'm trying to understand your reading of 1365. Mm-hmm. So this is a hypothetical question, I realize that. But if 1365 did not have the exception for governmental privileges...
It would be more unconstitutional.
It would be more unconstitutional.
It would be more unconstitutional, in our view.
More unconstitutional than what?
Than what it is right now, which is it only allows them to sue private parties, right? And so it's not an interbranch dispute, but you still have the point that...
I'm sorry, so you think it's unconstitutional as it is?
Yes, because it's still an institutional injury. It's not a private right within Reins. But the only point the last point I'll make on jurisdiction was just to say, it's not just a matter of judicial restraint. It's also a matter of there are good reasons why Congress as a whole might want to not allow these sort of suits. And it ties into our Article III standing point, which is, right now, disputes over information are resolved through the give and take of the political process. You go back and forth, and there's accommodations, and all of that is resolved between the branches. That will all vanish, if they have authority to file suits, because then the courts will resolve them, and their resolutions will bind for all time. And moreover...
But that's not quite right. I mean, 1365 has been around for quite a while, and I have some personal experience with the statute, and lots of accommodations were made over executive privilege.
No, see, that's the critical point, Your Honor. There, 1365, because it carves out the executive branch, they don't have the ability to sue over executive branch disputes. That's why they continue to be resolved in the political branch. That's Senator Specter and Senator Levin.
So that's why, in my hypothetical, take that language out and
it makes it worse, right?
I misunderstood.
And this isn't just some hypothetical. The day after the district court in this case ruled, the day after, they immediately filed another lawsuit over a different set of subpoenas. If this court authorizes standing and cause of action and starts adjudicating the merits of interbranch disputes over information, it will never end. There will be case after case after case, and this court will be in the business of resolving disputes between the branches over information. It won't be good for the courts, and it frankly won't be good for either of the political branches, because sometimes the House will lose some of those cases, and then they will have less power than they had before. That is why it makes it. That is why Senator Specter and Senator Levin quite reasonably said, we want to keep these disputes out of the courts and keep them within the political branches. That is the separation of powers norm that underlies all of this.
Of course, there may be another motivation to that view of the senators, but I won't go there.
Well, I will note it was bipartisan, Your Honor. It was Senator Specter and Levin.
But they're senators. Asserting their individual and the Senate's power, keep the courts out. We're familiar with that.
Yes, that's my point. That is exactly my point,
Your Honor. But I'm saying the motivation may be affected.
I think it well may be their point, right? The whole point is they are political actors and they want to have...
Judge Griffith keeps trying to push you to this constitutional question before us. And you want to come back to this, and that's all I'm saying, is the department now picking out its friends in legislative history.
No, look, Your Honor, I think my only point is that on the face of the statute, it carves off disputes against the executive branch. I think that is for good and sensible reasons, and the legislative history confirms those good and sensible reasons, that you don't want courts resolving these political issues. My final point is on cause of action, Your Honor, which is simply that even if you don't think that the statute actually displaces their jurisdiction, at a minimum, they have to actually have an affirmative ability to sue. And they have said that their affirmative ability to sue is an implied cause of action in equity. And there are two fundamental problems with that. The first is, we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Grupo Mexicano that implied cause of action in equity have to be traditionally justified. And they have no history of a suit by a congressional committee to enforce a subpoena. And in fact, the Supreme Court in the Reid decision said that there's a wide divergence between the ability to sue to enforce a subpoena and the ability to issue the subpoena. So they just can't meet this showing required for equity. And then the second is, Congress is essentially, even if you don't think Congress has displaced jurisdiction, Congress's decision to pass a statute that creates carefully limited causes of action for the Senate, surely this court shouldn't invent a cause of action for the House. At a minimum, again, Congress should have to speak on this before this court is thrust into the middle of these sort of political disputes. Your Honor, I know I'm well over my time. I'm happy to sit down.
I've got a question for you. It may be pedestrian. I asked you about, does anybody have standing? You said no. The lawyer in me has wondered from the beginning why there's no attorney-client privilege in this case. And you may be waiting until it either the separation of powers sweeps it, or you're waiting until the questions are asked and he can deny or refuse to answer based on attorney-client. But just like you answered my question, no one has standing. Is it your position that this goes to the, and I don't mean lowest in the sense that any federal employee is low, but the most menial type of employee? I know 1365 talks not only about officers, but employees.
So it depends which aspect of our argument you're asking about, Your Honor. Our standing and our jurisdictional and our cause of action arguments, all of those apply to all executive branch officers. There's no basis for distinguishing. Our merits argument, if the court reaches it, which we don't think it should, that is very much not. It is very much limited to the close advisors to the president, those who function as basically his alter ego.
But I didn't think you even mentioned attorney-client in the merits.
Well, we have a threshold argument, which is that they can't subpoena the close advisors of the president at all. But if the court were to disagree, and if Mr. McGann were to have to testify, of course, many of the questions, if not the predominance of the questions they would ask him, he would have a whole, not just attorney-client, but a bunch of executive privilege-based objections to the concrete questions. But we're not even at that point, Your Honor, because we don't think they have the authority to subpoena him at all, and we don't think they have the authority to sue to enforce that subpoena.
Well, again, the lawyer in me says, don't minimize attorney-client privilege. So, all right.
There are no further questions, Your Honor. I appreciate the time.
We'll give you some time to reply. Ms. Barbaro?
May it please the Court, Megan Barbaro on behalf of the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. Your Honors, the Department invokes separation of powers principles to argue that the committee does not have the right to come to court to seek enforcement of its valid subpoena, as would every other party that issued a subpoena. And they invoke separation of powers arguments, but if this court were to hold that the committee cannot get a judicial remedy to obtain the information it seeks in exercising its Article I authorities, that would shift the balance of powers significantly in favor of the executive branch and would leave the president the
arbiter. What about the remedies that your friend discussed? Congress has plenty of remedies. Appropriations power, confirmation power, impeachment power. There are lots of remedies that have been used for a long time. What's wrong with those?
Your Honor, the injury here is the deprivation of information to which the committee is entitled in exercising its impeachment and other Article I functions. It is true that the House has other remedies available to it, but as OLC recognized in 1984 and 1986, those other remedies are not effective in obtaining a remedy for this specific injury, that is, getting information in a timely fashion that the committee can use for its urgent priorities.
So I have a threshold question for you, if I might. So even if we were to agree with you that the president's claim to absolute testimonial immunity is, in this case, is extravagant, I wonder why we should be involved in this dispute at all, given the present posture. By what authority are you now pressing this appeal? Are you here to protect the legislative oversight authority of the House Judiciary Committee, or are you here because of the impeachment? Because arguably, our analysis of an immunity claim would differ based on whether you're here wearing the legislative oversight hat or whether you're wearing the impeachment hat. The articles of impeachment are all about the controversy over Ukraine. McGahn was long gone from the White House by then. He's a witness to possible obstruction of justice by the president, but the House has chosen not to press that matter. The only possible relevance McGahn would have to the impeachment is if you're here to tell me that the House may yet approve another article of impeachment. Is that the position of the committee and the speaker, that there may yet be another article of impeachment to which Mr. McGann's testimony would be pertinent?
Your Honor, there's a lot in that question, and I want to make sure that I answer all of it. The short answer to the first part of the question is that we are here pursuing this case both for the legislative and oversight purposes, and we all agree that the case is not moot because of those priorities that the committee has. But we are also
here. If you were only here on legislative oversight, we wouldn't have spent the holidays on an expedited basis, right? You're here because of the impeachment, so.
That is correct, and we remain here because of the impeachment, and I want to be very careful about how I answer the question in terms of the committee's continuing interest in testimony from Mr. McGann for the impeachment purposes, and also then walk through how it's relevant to the existing articles of impeachment and the ongoing investigation. And if we could turn in our supplemental brief on page 7, the committee laid out the position of the committee as blessed by the House. That McGann's testimony remains central to the committee's ongoing investigation into the president's obstructive conduct. And if his testimony produces new evidence supporting the conclusion that President Trump committed impeachable offenses that are not covered by the existing articles, the committee will proceed accordingly, including, if necessary, by considering whether to recommend additional articles.
So you're saying there may be new articles of impeachment coming? Could be. That's a possibility. The two that we have, you're saying, and you're saying this on the authority of the Speaker? You have authority to say this from the Speaker of the House, that there may be yet other articles of impeachment coming?
Your Honor, I am here saying exactly what we said in our supplemental brief, which was said with the full authority of the House, which is, and just taking a step back, as a matter of first principles, the fact that the President has been impeached by the House on two articles does not mean that the House could not, if Mr. McGann testifies and there's additional relevant evidence of misconduct, use that information both, and we can get to how that's relevant to the existing articles, for its decision-making with respect to how to proceed in the current impeachment, for any trial in the Senate for which that evidence is relevant, and also, as we said in the supplemental brief, for considering whether to
Mr. McGann's possible testimony is only relevant in the impeachment trial with the present articles of impeachment. How is it? He was gone. This is the two articles are all about the Ukraine controversy. He's gone from the White House by then.
Your Honor, the second article of impeachment relates to obstruction of Congress. And if we look, this is House Resolution 755.
Obstruction of Congress in the Ukraine controversy.
That's correct with respect to the specific misconduct in that article. But the article also refers to the president's previous efforts to undermine federal governmental investigations into foreign interference in United States elections. And as the committee made clear in its report, that pattern of misconduct is relevant to consideration of this second article, including whether the remedy of removal is appropriate remedy. And that's outlined, as we detailed in our brief, in the Judiciary Committee report that accompanied these articles of impeachment. And in addition, of course, if McGann came in to testify, and he was, as we've laid out, an eyewitness to several of the allegations of the president's misconduct and interfering.
So it's a pattern and practice argument you would be making, right?
It is the pattern of misconduct that would be relevant. And again, that is information that the Judiciary Committee is continuing to pursue. That is part of why we have pressed this appeal, asked this court to move expeditiously, because that information would be relevant to the committee and leaders in the House in making decisions about how to proceed, and that remains true given the current state of affairs with the articles of impeachment. And we, regardless, again, we are here for both those impeachment purposes and also because the committee from the outset has been considering important remedial legislation, including to govern interactions between the White House and DOJ and the FBI, including to govern foreign offers of contributions to political action committees and individuals in upcoming elections. Those are legislative priorities that are also time sensitive, we had expedited, for example, the Mazars appeal, which was not an impeachment subpoena, but was based on legislative and oversight priorities. And for all those reasons, we'd urge the court to rule expeditiously.
I have just a technical question. You heard counsel for McGann say that the subpoena only seeks testimony. I read both the complaint and the subpoena talking about testimony and evidence, talking about creating a false record. I read that to be more than oral testimony. Am I correct, or did the committee, as counsel argued this morning, only seek McGann testimony, oral testimony?
Your Honor, you are correct that the subpoena sought both Mr. McGann's testimony and related documents, all of which the schedules attached to the subpoena. Now, we did reach an agreement with the department with respect to the documents. I'm not sure the status of that production, but that the document aspect of this, as the district court noted, is no longer the issue in the appeal. It's related to having McGann appear and testify and provide testimonial evidence.
Well, you reached agreement. Was it a stipulation that the committee would not seek any other documents? Were the testimony to reveal the likelihood of other documents relevant to that testimony?
I don't.
That's what I'm trying to understand
no,
here.
The short answer is no. I believe that it was an accommodation such that they would produce the documents that had
all
been
right.
sought.
I won't pursue this, but I mean, the record speaks for itself. But I don't know what the terms of this private agreement, not private, but accommodation was.
I do. There was significant discussion of the Raines case, and I would like to start there with respect to standing, because we do fundamentally disagree about the meaning and import of the Raines decision. The holding in that case, as the Supreme Court has made clear in later cases, is that individual legislators, and in that case it was six members of Congress who had lost the vote on an act, did not have standing, that is, they did not have a concrete and particularized injury to assert an institutional interest in the dilution of legislative power, which was an interest that belonged to Congress as a whole.
What do you do with your friend's argument that the reasoning supporting that holding is much broader than you maintain?
And the reasoning, we heard several times about the three pages of history that's discussed in Raines, but those historical examples relate to the lack of challenges between the executive and legislative branches about the constitutionality of duly enacted statutes that had been passed through bicameralism and presentment. This is a different kind of...
Well, those are the facts, but that's not what the discussion talks about. The discussion talks about the diminution in power is not a basis... Diminution of power by one branch of the government is not a basis for Article III standing. The facts of the cases that Chief Justice Rehnquist listed in his parade of horribles may have involved constitutionality of the statute, but the reasoning that the Chief Justice, was he Chief Justice at the time? Yeah, the Chief Justice at the time used, I think, is broader than that. So tell me about the reasoning. His reasoning talks about diminution in power of a branch of government is not sufficient grounds to satisfy Article III standing. That's a problem for you.
A few responses, Your Honor. First, this isn't about the diminution of power of a branch of government. This is a case about a subpoena that the committee issued. It's the reasoning in Raines is going
I thought your whole argument was that the injury that the House Judiciary Committee has suffered is frustrating its ability to carry out its investigation. Isn't it given the power that you say that the Constitution gives to it?
To clarify, though, that is a power that is vested in the House and delegated to this committee. Mm-hmm. This committee is the plaintiff in this case. The question for standing purposes is trying to determine whether the plaintiff is asserting an injury that is a particularized injury to that plaintiff. That is what distinguishes the committee in this case, which has issued a subpoena and is entitled to information in response to that subpoena, from the plaintiffs in Raines, who were asserting an interest that belonged to the legislature as a whole. This is a case where the plaintiff, in the words of the Supreme Court in later cases, there is a match between the plaintiff and the injury asserted. And Raines certainly...
But Raines is about more than just that you're being injured. It's a certain... There are only certain types of injuries that are justiciable, right? And as I read, as I understand your friend's argument about Raines, he's saying that the Supreme Court says this type of, the type of injury to a branch of Congress that is as amorphous, not as amorphous, that diminishes their power. When they come to the courts to say the executive has done something to diminish our power, that's not the type of dispute that we're supposed to referee. We're not an ombudsman over the operations of government, as I think Justice Frankfurter may have said in Youngstown or something. That's not our job.
A few responses, Your Honor, though. It is important to return to the particular facts of this case because the courts have long been adjudicating the validity of subpoenas, including subpoenas directed at the president and senior executive branch officials. That was the case in United States v. Burr that Chief Justice Marshall decided in 1807. Now, I understand there are additional separation of powers concerns and an overlay of an interbranch dispute here. But a few points on...
It's a criminal proceeding, right?
That is correct. But
the criminal proceedings, there are also proceedings where the rights of individuals are at stake, but none. I don't think you have any instances where the institutional interest of the Congress is has been injured and therefore is cognizable.
Well, as this court recently recognized in the Mazars decision, there is a long history that predates the founding of our nation of legislative subpoenas.
But Mazars is a subpoena to a non-governmental actor, right? The accounting firm. But as I understand your friend's argument, I don't need to make it for him, I'm using this to get your response to it, is that unlike what the district court said, this isn't a garden variety subpoena enforcement. This is a dispute over information between two political branches of government. It's a very different sort of creature than the typical subpoena enforcement matter.
And in that respect, it's very much like this court's decision in AT&T, which this court understood to be an interbranch dispute. That was a case where a House subcommittee had subpoenaed AT&T for records relating to an FBI wiretap.
But the problem with AT&T and Senate Select Committee is, and it comes back to the argument about Raines, if we read Raines narrowly, as you urge us to do, then it seems to me that AT&T and Senate Select Committee have some force that we need to account for. If your friend is right that Raines is broader than that, then AT&T and Senate Select Committee are suspect. They are from a day when this court engaged in some expeditious ventures into legislative standing. Those, as I said jokingly before, the bad old days have been changed. Isn't that right? Isn't that the issue? The issue is, if we agree with you that Raines should be read narrowly, then AT&T and Senate Select Committee may tell us there is standing here. If we disagree with you and we say that what Raines was really about, the reasoning of Raines was to warn us against getting involved, as Justice Souter said in his concurrence, getting involved in these disputes, then you lose.
If I could push back on the premise of the question, we are not advocating a narrow reading of Raines. We are advocating a reading of Raines that is consistent with the holding in that case, which is in the last paragraph of the opinion, is also consistent with the reasoning, which relates to different types of interbranch disputes and the lack of a history about disputes over the constitutionality of enacted statutes. The question in Raines was whether the plaintiff was the correct plaintiff to assert the injury there. That is the question in every Article III standing case. The Supreme Court has characterized Raines that way in its later decisions. We know it mattered that it was individual legislators at issue in Raines, and nothing about Raines overrules this court's very clear holding in AT&T.
Doesn't Chenoweth suggest that it does?
Chenoweth was a case about, again, members asserting an amorphous dilution of legislative power. this is, again, I keep going back to this, but it matters here that this is a subpoena enforcement case. This is the type of dispute that the courts are very familiar with answering. And even if there are political questions at issue in this case, as we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Zivotofsky, even if there are political issues the courts would gladly avoid, it is the duty of the court in a case that is otherwise justiciable, and we've submitted that this one clearly is consistent with this court's precedent and a long history of practice between the branches, to say what the law is. That is what we are asking the court to do, is to issue a ruling that Mr. McGahn, who, again, he is a private citizen, he's a former presidential aide, to the extent the concern is that this dispute is not sufficiently particularized because there's not individual rights at issue. The committee has subpoenaed a private citizen to appear and testify and provide relevant evidence. He's in many respects similar to AT&T in that respect. The executive has asserted an absolute immunity defense that is unfounded in the law, and we are asking the court to resolve that issue so that the committee can expeditiously obtain the information it needs in response to the subpoena. Now, I'd like to talk as well, unless there are further questions on standing, about subject matter jurisdiction and going to the plain language of Section 1331, which makes very clear that there is jurisdiction over the committee's suit in this case, which arises under the Constitution and laws of the United States, as this court said in AT&T in 1976. Their argument is essentially an implied repeal argument. To the extent they're looking at legislative history or other factors, we know that the courts disfavor implied repeals, particularly in the jurisdictional context. Nothing about 1365 repeals jurisdiction for House subpoenas under 1331, because, of course, 1365 deals only with Senate subpoenas. And whatever limitations are in 1365 with respect to the Senate are neither here nor there with respect to whether the House has jurisdiction and continues to have jurisdiction under this court's reasoning in AT&T over House subpoena enforcement actions. If there are questions about 1365, I'm happy to address those, but otherwise I'll just briefly say that there is...
What do you do with your friend's argument based on legislative history, the statements of Senator Specter and Senator Levin?
Your Honor, in 1996, the Senate was attempting to clarify 1365 with respect to a specific issue that had arisen for executive branch officials who asserted personal privileges, to make clear that those were covered by 1365 and there was jurisdiction. To the extent there are statements by individual senators in the legislative history about what that clarifying amendment meant, again, that doesn't have anything to do with House subpoena enforcement disputes, and any limitations that the Senate understood might be imposed by 1365, certainly there's no basis for imposing those on the House, particularly where what the department is asking is that this court recognize an implied repeal of a jurisdictional grant over jurisdiction over House subpoenas, and those are certainly disfavored, and any ambiguous legislative history is not enough to overcome the burden that they would have to meet to find the 1365 strip jurisdiction that would otherwise exist under 1331.
Point. I mean, Congress is part of the government too. This is just the Department of Justice's argument in support of McGahn's position.
Correct.
Said the government.
I tried to catch myself when I was. I had previously worked at the Department of Justice. I'm still in that habit, but I'm adjusting to my new role. So I apologize for misspeaking. And on the cause of action question, two points there. One is my friend on the other side mentioned Grupo Mexicano. That case is about a very different circumstance, where the question was whether a court sitting in equity could exercise jurisdiction that had historically not existed at all over real property before there had been a judgment. And the facts are very specific. The holding is very specific in that case.
So as I understand the department's argument here is, and maybe I'm putting words in counsel's mouth, but he's willing to acknowledge that these cases may be distinguishable on factual grounds. But I understand his argument to be that the court in Raines and elsewhere basically was laying down a path for the courts to be very wary of entering this type of dispute. And it gave the reasons why. And so to the extent Raines signals that for the courts, almost saying don't try it because here's what's going to happen if you do, then the question, it seems to me, is where Raines says, well, there may be factors that work nevertheless in favor of the courts entering this area. And when we look at those factors, such as the history of what's been going on, counsel makes the point, you can't find anything like this. And of course, Judge Griffith's question points out, well, maybe there's never been a situation like this, because in the past, the Department of Justice, the President, and the Attorney General have not interposed objections to supplying information to the committees. I think that's the hurdle that we're trying to address here, because there are fine arguments, and I realize that courts can evolve, but nevertheless, Raines is a fairly broad statement, and it says, it doesn't close the door completely. I don't read it to close the door completely to the extent the department is arguing this morning, but it's very strong language, isn't it? And we can parse these cases to distinguish precisely who the plaintiff is and that type of thing. And to that extent, the committee can argue, well, it's an open question before this court, and it's an open question if and when the case goes to the Supreme Court. But that's the response we're trying to get from you.
A few responses, Your Honor. One, with respect to the question of how this has worked between the branches, I would direct the court to page 48 of our brief, where we point to a number of examples where, contrary to what the department has said, legislative subpoenas were issued to senior members of the executive branch, including White House counsel and former White House counsel, who appeared and testified under subpoena.
Voluntarily, as I understand the department's position.
Voluntarily in the sense that we didn't have to bring a court action to get a judicial judgment requiring them to comply with a valid congressional subpoena.
But isn't that the whole point of your friend's argument, that you didn't have to do that and you got it? And that in the place of a court coming in and picking a winner or a loser, the nation's history has been negotiation, compromise, accommodation. It's messy. It takes time. It involves all these tools that you can't use in the court. But that's what the separation of powers means. Isn't that his very point?
And we would have been happy to have reached an accommodation in this case, because it would have meant that Mr. McGann would have already shown up and testified and provided the information.
Cut the appropriations. Cut the appropriations. Stop. Get the Senate to stop confirming judges. Make it an article of impeachment. You're not without remedy here.
But the fact that
the question is whether the Constitution allows you to pull the courts, and I'm just channeling Justice Souter's concurrence right now, whether the Constitution allows you to pull the courts into this dispute that historically has been fought out, duked out between the political branches. That's, to me, that's the tough question. And what Raines has to say about that. That's it.
Right. And I understand the concern. The fact that there are other remedies that would be available to Congress, I think, really underscores that Congress has the power, that Supreme Court has long recognized this power, there is no dispute, to issue subpoenas and obtain compliance with those subpoenas. We have come to this court seeking an orderly and effective resolution of this dispute, including about a core legal question on absolute immunity that is the type of legal question that the court has answered in the past, that is traditionally justiciable, capable of judicial resolution. It's been answered in our favor and against the government's favor every time an analogous claim has been raised. Notwithstanding that, we are in a situation now where there has been an unprecedented refusal to comply by this administration with valid congressional subpoenas, and the committee is continuing in an attempt to exercise its constitutional functions and do its job under Article 1 to obtain orderly resolution of this dispute. And that is why we are here. And the core questions in this case are questions that the court is well positioned to resolve. They relate to whether Mr. McGahn, a former aide and private citizen, is required to comply with a congressional subpoena.
And just so I understand, so if we were to affirm the district court, what happens then? Mr. McGahn shows up before the committee, he's sworn in, he's asked questions, and then he interposes objections, right?
That is what we would expect.
And, what happens then?
Well, so
he says, I can't speak because I'm a close aide to the president, there's executive privilege, what happens then?
I mean, one option, of course, is that if this court were to rule in our favor and reject the absolute immunity defense, that we could reopen the discussion with the department about the appropriate way
for
the committee
to obtain. But what happens in my hypothetical? He comes and he invokes executive privilege.
The president has not invoked executive privilege with respect to Mr. McGahn. He has only...
What happens if he does? My hypothetical is that he does. What happens then?
Right, and as the district court made clear in her opinion, those questions, while teed up in our complaint, have not been resolved by this opinion. We're not asking this court for a resolution here. And any executive privilege claim that was valid and asserted, again, as we've argued in the brief, it is another reason to reject the absolute immunity defense that he doesn't come in and
but what happens
testify
next?
At all.
He comes in, he asserts executive privilege. What happens next? If you're the Senate, you couldn't come here to get a resolution of that dispute. But you're not the Senate, you're the House, you argue that...
And we expect, consistent with our complaint and the papers we filed in district court, that we would go back to the district court for a resolution of those questions, if and when they were teed up. But again, if this court were to rule in our favor, we would expect to reopen the accommodations process and hopefully reach a resolution that would allow us to avoid continuing to litigate the case. And just one final point I wanted to make, if I may, which is the imbalance in terms of the argument here, particularly on standing, that a committee of the House exercising its Article I authorities, unlike every other litigant who issues a subpoena, and unlike what I understand the Department of Justice would do if Mr. McGahn actually said he would appear and testify, I expect that they would, as they have done in other cases relating to our subpoenas, that they would go to court to seek to prevent him from doing that. And in their view, they would have subject matter jurisdiction, a cause of action, and standing to do that, but they would like to keep the Judiciary Committee out of court from getting a court determination on the same question about the same subpoenas. There are no further questions.
All right, thank you. Does Mr. Moop have any time? All right, why don't you take 3 minutes?
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'll try to squeeze 3 points in the 3 minutes. On standing, my friend basically wants this court to read Raines narrowly to its facts and ignore its reasoning, but read AT&T broadly and rely on its lack of reasoning. As we talked about, we agree the facts of Raines were a case involving individual members, but the reasoning goes much more broadly. And I don't think that we heard any explanation of why that reasoning doesn't apply here. There was some suggestion that there's, information is somehow obviously an injury. Well, take, for example, the examples that were given in Raines. Of course, the Tenure of Office Act, interfering with the ability of an executive to fire their subordinate would clearly be an injury if it was imposed on a private party. If Congress told a private CEO he couldn't fire his subordinate, of course that CEO could sue. And of course the legal question was susceptible to resolution. It was, in fact, in Clinton. What did all of the work in Raines, all of the work, was the fact that it was the chief executive, it was the president, not some private party. Conversely, They emphasize that this is information that Congress needs. Well, the point is, as Judge Griffith emphasized, they need the information in furtherance of their legislative prerogatives. It is only, as Rain said, an injury to official authority or power. But let me give a very stark and simple example to show why they're wrong about this. Imagine if someone was stealing property out of Congress, just going in and stealing computers. They couldn't file a lawsuit to stop that. They couldn't file a conversion action or a criminal action. What they would have to do is come to the executive branch and ask the Department of Justice to file those lawsuits. And why? Because under our Constitution, the ability to file lawsuits on behalf of the United States to mitigate injuries to the government is vested in the executive. That's the square holding of Buckley versus Vallejo, is that the problem was there that the FEC, staffed by members of the legislature, had the ability to bring enforcement actions. So it's not some sort of oddity that they need to rely on the executive branch to bring lawsuits. That is how the structure works, and the way it works is through political process, through the political tools. If they're not happy with how the executive branch is complying with its obligations and bringing suits, they have political tools, ample tools, over legislation and appropriations and nominations and all the rest. Just like the executive branch, if we're not happy with the subpoenas they're issuing, we have our tools. What you don't have is federal courts stepping in the middle of that political food fight, because that politicizes the judiciary. The second point and the last point I'll make is...
Can I just be clear then? Is your view that the opinions of the Office of Legal Counsel that recognized these remedies were not, these alternative remedies were not adequate in this context, is no longer good law?
I'm not quite sure what Your Honor is referring to, but
you can't just pass legislation on a unicameral basis. So the notion that the Senate at this stage is going to go along with some of these things, it's nice to write a law review article about, but the reality of the world is two branches at loggerheads here. And the question really is, the fundamental question, we have three branches of government. Is there no proper role for the courts? And your answer is no. Not in this type of dispute. Either they have to duke it out or nothing happens. And the fact that one branch and one part of a branch is stymied in what the Founding Fathers thought was a critical power in terms of checking abuse of presidential power, and here the allegation is made that that is what happened. We have yet to have a trial on that. But that's so fundamental to the form of government we have. And as you know, the Justice Department has previously taken the position that the courts have no role when the president is exercising certain Article II powers. And the Supreme Court has said, no, there is a role. All right, it may be a limited role, but there is a role. And that's what I think we're struggling with here.
Your Honor.
I get your argument, but if we don't have a case on all fours, then you're saying constitutional avoidance. You have the message from the Supreme Court.
So I'll say a couple things in response to that, Your Honor. First is bicameralism and presentment is a feature, not a bug, of our constitutional system. I think Campbell versus Clinton recognizes that.
No. I mean, you can't pass an act of Congress without two houses.
That's my point.
That's it.
Yeah, the fact that their political tools require effort and require accommodation within the branches and across the branches, that's the whole point of our constitutional
system. No, but I'm getting at the point. We're at the point now where there is no such cooperation in our constitutional system.
Just let me give an example this way.
Was identified as a fundamental need for this government to continue to operate effectively.
Just like Your Honor, Congress has very conveniently carved themselves out of FOIA, and there's nothing the executive branch can do about that other than put political pressure on them. We can't just pass a law that says, you know what, Congress is subject to FOIA now. That's how the political process works. The political branches use whatever tools they have, and if they don't have enough tools because they don't have enough political support in the Senate and in the public, that's how it works, and that's what Campbell versus Clinton recognized. If I could just make one last point on jurisdiction, which is my friend said that it's just, if you look at 1331, it's clear that they could file a lawsuit, and so this is an implied repeal case. Well, it wasn't so clear to the D.C. Circuit in 1981. This is from the application case that I cited to you earlier. Prior to 1978, Congress had only two means of enforcing compliance with its subpoenas, a statutory criminal contempt mechanism and the inherent congressional contempt power. Nor was it clear to Congress when it passed 1365, this is from the Senate report, need for civil enforcement of subpoenas. Presently, Congress can seek to enforce a subpoena only by use of criminal proceedings or by the impractical procedure of conducting its own trial before the bar of the House of Representatives or the Senate. It is simply anachronistic for them to suggest that everyone always knew that 1331 was lurking in the background and they can invoke it. There's just no history or tradition of it. You can avoid the serious Article III constitutional questions by saying that at a minimum Congress has to speak, but we do think that Article III says that this is not a proper suit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.